Well, then I'll say we're at 4310 Southwest McAdam.
Yes, so we've been here at live at Occupy ICE and in Portland, and you can check our website kboo.fm for when we will be live from the encampment again. And so do keep tuned in to KBOO 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland, and we're signing off. Thank you so much to our guests for joining us from Occupy ICE.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Iran Forum, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The Iran Forum will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
KBOO.
KBOO programming is made possible by listener members and support from Portland Underground Grad School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones' Neighborhood. Our guests today are Portland-based publishers Harley MacArthur of Tin House, Rhonda Hughes of Hawthorne Books, and Kevin Samsel of Future Tense Books. Joining us live in the KBOO studios, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for...
Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. You know, Mr. Jones himself is barely literate, but the Portland metropolitan area is decidedly not. We're a city of great readers and writers, and fortunately for those readers and writers, great independent publishers. We have three of those publishers live with us in the KBOO studios right now: Holly MacArthur of Tin House, Rhonda Hughes of Hawthorne Books, and Kevin Samsel of Future Tense Books. Holly, Rhonda, Kevin, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Ken.
Rhonda, let's start with you, going in alphabetical order by surname. I thought that was fair. You started Hawthorne Books in 2001, so you're going on 18 years now, which is incredible for an indie publisher, actually any publisher these days. Did you have any idea back in 2001 that Hawthorne would have such longevity?
No, I had no idea. And when I started Hawthorne, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to be a publisher. I knew that I wanted to be an editor, and to be an editor and not move away from Portland, I had to start my own press. And it took me, honestly, 10 years to learn the business.
Starting at 2001, huh?
Yeah, so the first decade was a learning curve, honestly. So.
And you came to book publishing from a career in book production and printing. You led production for Toppin Printing.
Topan,
yeah. In San Francisco.
Yes.
And you worked with some major publishers in the Bay Area, including UC Berkeley.
Yes.
How did that lead you to Portland and Hawthorne Books?
I was a director of sales at a small overseas printing corporation, and I wanted actually to be a partner at that place, and the man who owned it said, okay, we'll think about it. I was 29 years old, and he hired somebody, a young man from an advertising agency, in over me and promoted him, and I thought, oh, I don't think I'm going to go any further with this particular group, so
the
I'm going to have
glass ceiling there.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to leave and start my own. And that's how I left San Francisco and came to Portland.
And when you started Hawthorne Books, your first book was Poe Ballantyne.
Yeah, Things I Like About America.
Now, he's one of my favorite writers. And after meeting him last week, we interviewed him for Between the Covers. He's one of my favorite people, just a wonderful guy.
Yes.
Very funny, very modest. How did that first book from Poe come about? And now you have a very long-term author-publisher relationship.
He's my Charles Bukowski.
Yes, I was just going to mention that.
Black Sparrow and Charles Bukowski, kind of similarity there. I had been reading Poe's essays in The Sun. I think I started reading them in 1992. I would get The Sun magazine, and I would immediately go to the table of contents and see if there was a new essay by Poe. And then I was always really happy when there was. And so in 2001, it occurred to me, I've never seen this guy published. And I checked, and there aren't any books out by Poe Ballantyne. So I sent an email to Cy Safransky saying, can you please forward this to Poe?
And he's the publisher at The Sun.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. And my email to Poe said, I've read so many essays over the years by you, I've got to imagine there's enough work for a collection. And he said, well, there is.
And you hit him at the right time. He actually has written some essays on this. He had a multi-book deal with Houghton Mifflin just before he hooked up with Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. And he called it a failure. But looking back in hindsight, it was quite successful.
Yeah, for me.
Well, I also think for readers, he had he mentions an editor there that was somewhat, I can't say the word, obsessive. Let me use a synonym for what I was thinking of. Editors are often called what I was thinking of, though.
Yeah.
So,
well, in all fairness to this editor, you know, the writer-editor relationship can be emotional and fraught, and it may not have, you know, been all on her. It could have been the dynamics.
Well, it worked out well for Poe and Hawthorne, I think.
Yeah.
And in addition to Poe, you've published some wonderful writers. Well, actually, they probably all are. I know Karen Carbo, Tom Spanbauer, Ariel Gore, Lydia Yuknovich, Monica Drake, and Natalie Singer, who we interviewed also for Between the Covers. What do you look for when deciding to work with an author and publish their writing?
What I look for is a story. And usually I like the kind of stories that are dealing with serious life transitions, the kind of issues that we all deal with but maybe don't talk easily about. You know, like I say, there's subjects that you don't necessarily talk about over Thanksgiving table, you know, like sex and death and addiction and these things that make us feel more connected to community when we do kind of grapple with them together. And then I like it, the manuscript, of course, to be well written, or at least in a particular form that I think I can mold it.
I read an interview with you where you mentioned there was one writer, was it Scott Nadelson, who hands in like perfect manuscripts?
I don't change a comma. Scott Nadelson's work is pristine. I think that he just crafts it. And then by the time he gives it to me, it goes right to the copy editor.
So it's an editor's gift to have a writer like that.
Yeah, he's an amazing writer.
Oh, one more question for you, Rhonda, directly. Hawthorne Books recently entered a partnership with DeZank Books. I think I pronounced that right. I looked it up, and there were several different pronunciations on the web. So that's close, I think. Anyway, it's a DZANC, and it's based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Can you tell us about the partnership and what that means for Hawthorne and your role?
Right. Well, there actually isn't a partnership with DeZank. What we did is Stephen Gillis is the publisher of DeZank, and he needed a publicity director. And I needed a better deal with my distributor, and his deal was better with our distributor than mine was. And so we made an exchange. We said, we are going to tell my distributor that I'm an imprint. But I wasn't. I just needed to get a lower deal.
Oh.
And then I handled the publicity for DeZank just for a year out of my offices, and we had interns there. And then we just had a year contract, and that was it.
Oh, okay. So Hawthorne's still independent, and you
absolutely
make all the editorial
yes
decisions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Holly MacArthur, you've also enjoyed great longevity in the publishing business as one of the founders of Tin House, and that was back in 1999,
mm-hmm,
with Wynn McCormick, Rob Spillman, Alyssa Chappell.
Yep.
How did that come about, the four of you getting together and starting publishing a magazine and later became a book publisher?
Well, I was working at Eco Traveler magazine, and it was about to fold. And Lisa Tabb, the woman who started Eco Traveler, met Wynn McCormick and Alan Santafonte, who was in Skies America here. And Alan wanted to start a travel magazine, and that was my past. That was always what I did. And so we were introduced, and Wynn decided not to fund that for reasons I won't go into. But he said, you know, I could work with you, Holly. And you know what I really want to do is a literary magazine, one that's like has elements of glossy magazines that makes it more readable to people. And I said, well, okay, but, you know, I'm not an English major. I'm a journalism major. And he said, well, that's okay. You know, I live in New York. A lot of the time I'm here. So I think I'll just leave you with a stack of books. And when I come back, we'll talk about them. It was a dream. I was being paid to read. And we agreed on most things, except for there was one author I didn't like that he liked.
Oh, so he chose those books
for you to read? Oh, yeah, because he wanted to make sure we were you know, that we were on the same page. So.
Oh, yeah, literally.
Yeah.
But could you mention some of those? Do you remember any of the writers, the books?
Italo Calvino.
Wow.
And,
so some pretty high-level literary books.
Yeah. Banana Yamamoto, Yakima.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So anyway, we would get together and talk about books, and he's like, okay, I think you're ready. I want to hire you. We're going to do this magazine, and we need to have a New York presence. So let's go to New York. You know, we'll put an ad out. We'll go to New York and find someone who could be editor. And so Randy Gregg, actually, from here, you know, Randy, suggested Rob and Alyssa, and we hired them to share the job of editor. And as time went by, Alyssa got more involved in writing her own books and having babies. So Rob then took over. And it's been great ever since. We came up with the name Tin House together. It was really hard. We were trying to come up with clever names, but the building in which we work looks like tin, but it's actually zinc. And it was always the working title. When Wynn and I were talking about, you know, the magazine and doing stuff, I said, well, you know, I'll just meet you at the Tin House. So eventually we just said, let's just call it that. And so
there's no plans to change the name to Zinc House.
Right. No, yeah. Not as catchy.
In the interest
not
of accuracy.
Catchy.
Okay.
Exactly.
And now it's an extremely prestigious magazine, known the world over. You publish the best writers in the world, actually.
Thank you.
Tin House also runs a summer workshop in Portland. I read now there's winter workshops at the Oregon
yes,
coast.
Yes, great.
Plus the books.
Mm-hmm.
Are you exclusively working on the magazine now? Are there some interconnections there with the other branches of Tin House?
Let's just say I know more about what's happening at the magazine. And we work in separate buildings, but there's a lot of commingling, and we have meetings once a week together, so we know what's going on at books, and they know what's going on at magazines and workshop. And so, yeah, I mean, but I do. Magazine was my first love there. So
now each magazine has a theme.
Not each. We do two that are themed, two that are non. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I've been looking at the theme magazines. I was going to ask how you pick a theme. Well, you do two a year then,
yes,
on the theme. And then how do you get the short stories, the essays, the poetry to fit that theme? Do you solicit
yes,
authors?
We do. And we tell agents, and, you know, we have meetings every Wednesday, and when it comes time to pick a theme, we just, you know, brainstorm and, hey, oh, that's good, you know, boom. And so it's just pretty organic. And then once we have that, each editor has his or her people that they reach out to, and, you know, and then we also publicize it. So we take unsolicited or agented, yeah.
And you and I met through an amazing writer, Paul Cohen.
Right.
And he was in town for a reading here, plus we interviewed him for Between the Covers. His book was The Glam Shack, published last year, a novel. In addition to Paul, are there other writers that you would recommend to our listeners? Maybe some of them that listeners might not know of? You know, the lesser-known great writers in our country.
Well, what comes to mind, and I can't even believe I'm blanking on the author's name, but actually the Tin House book that just came out this earlier this month, who was Vera Katz, or Vera, who's Vera Kelly?
Vera Katz was a mayor, wasn't it?
Yeah, who was answer, mayor.
Right.
No. So I would definitely recommend everyone read that.
Oh, Vera Kelly? And what's the name of the book?
That's the name of the book.
Oh, okay.
And I'm just blanking on the author's name.
Oh, okay.
I think, so one of my favorite Tin House authors is a poet named Tommy Pico. Mm-hmm. Amazing. I mean, we've gotten some great poets. Morgan Parker. I mean, so I would definitely say to people, I used to be sort of afraid of poetry until we got these really great poets. And Matthew Dickman's one of my favorites,
too.
Oh, yeah,
Portland-based.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's what I would say.
Well, Matthew publishes in The New Yorker, too. So,
oh, yeah.
So he might be one of the better-known poets.
Well, true.
Poets.
So,
yeah, but we could still mention him.
Yeah, plug.
Now, Kevin, let's get to you. I'm going to try to make you blush.
All right.
Portland writer Justin Hocking, who was also a former director of our IPRC, the Independent Publishing Resource Center here in Portland, said about you, Kevin is the hot, beating heart of the Portland literary world. Almost everything important that happens here in terms of books circulates through him in some way. And doing the research, I know what he means. In addition to your role of publisher at Future Tense, you're also the author of three books. There's a novel, This Is Between Us, from Tin House. the memoir, Common Pornography, from Harper Perennial, so big New York publisher. And the short story collection, I think your first, Creamy Bullets, which was from, is it Chiasmus? That was Lydia Yuknovich's press, right? I don't think they're around anymore, but they published your first book. And you edited the collection Portland Noir in 2009. You work at Powell's Books in Portland as both event coordinator and manager of the small press section.
Yes.
Given all your literary endeavors, why start a publishing company? Do you ever sleep?
Well, I think the publishing company was actually the first thing, and then all these other things kind of came after. Really, the real reason was basically because I wanted to do my own books, and I didn't know how to get published. This was a long time ago.
Like 1995 or so?
Yeah, this is pre-Hawthorne even. This is before I even moved to Portland, basically. Like in 1990, I was living in Spokane. And I started making my own chapbooks. So they're basically kind of like zines. You know, I would actually go to Kinko's and, you know, pre-computer, like cut and paste the layout and make copies and staple
Xeroxes
them.
At Kinko's.
Yeah. Ah. So a lot of the early Future Tense stuff were really lo-fi stapled sort of things. And I moved to Portland in 92 and that was the first time I enjoyed Spokane okay. I lived in Arkansas for a brief time before Portland. But Portland was the first time where I felt that I was surrounded by a lot of writers that kind of got what I was trying to do and a lot of other people in the community who were supportive. And it was really exciting because, you know, like I said, I kind of started off doing publishing my own little things. And then after doing like five or six little chapbooks like that, I started to publish other people's stuff. And that became exciting and rewarding. And it was just a way to, you know, become a part of the community and to help others in the community to get their stuff out.
Do you remember some of those first writers you published as chapbooks after your own work?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think the first one's Melody Jordan, who was a Portland poet who still lives here in town. Jeff Myers, who also worked with Hawthorne later on. I published a book of his poetry, and he's great, and he's still around. He lives in California now. Verlina Orr, who's a longtime Portland poet, she's still around, and I published a chapbook of hers like in 96 or something like that.
How did you distribute those early ones? Did you go to bookstores and just say, here's a few chapbooks, sell them if you can?
Yeah, chapbooks are a little harder to get bookstores excited about, but I would do that a little bit. We had a website, early website, so we would mail stuff to people. We would sell stuff at Powell's before I even started working at Powell's, and there were people that did the small press section at that point. Vanessa Rennick, who was pretty influential person in my life, being like the small press connection at Powell's when I first moved here, she was really key. And and sometimes I would go to Seattle, or if I was like in another city, I would find like the whatever bookstore would be good for that kind of stuff, and I would go in there to like Quimby's in Chicago or City Lights in San Francisco, and I'd be like, here's my little staple chapbooks, do you want some? And and it was cool. Back then, pre-email, I'm sounding so old talking about like all this like ancient stuff, but like back then people would send letters in the mail, so I had I have this P.O. box I've had for 20 something years, and I would get letters from people, and people would order stuff, and I would send stuff through the mail, so it was a lot of like mail activity. But a lot of those chapbooks too, keep in mind, were only I'd print like 200 copies
limited
or something
editions.
Like that, so it was pretty small. Yeah, and then I got into doing more paperback stuff, like, late 90s, and especially, like, in the past, like, 12 or 15 years, it's been more paperbacks and less chapbooks. Mm-hmm. But we still do chapbooks once or twice a year.
Now, when you mention Powell's, it seems like they've always been supportive to small press, independent publishers. It's always been a common denominator when I talk to writers. Probably the major reason why Portland is such a good literary town, I would think. Certain Powell's must be in the top three there.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I moved to Portland.
Oh, it was really. Powell's. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, just to be around Powell's and then to end up working there, 5 years later.
Yeah, I read a blog post on your website, so not Future Tense, but kevinsamsel.com or whatever it is. You mentioned your 20th anniversary working there. You write, being a bookseller, event coordinator, and champion of small presses at the largest bookstore in the world feels like my calling, perhaps even more important than being a writer or publisher. But then you say, but all of this time, this life, wouldn't have been possible if I hadn't fell in love with the transformative act of reading before bookselling, before writing, before publishing. I was a reader. So
yeah,
that's something.
And I was a late reader, too.
oh, really?
Because I didn't start really seriously reading books until I was like 20, 21. I didn't read that much in high school or middle school. Yeah, it's
what were those first books, and which ones turned on the light?
It's just cheesy stuff. I mean, I kind of started off like reading like true crime stuff. Like I think there was a couple of true crime things that I was like, this is juicy and it's good. And then I started reading. I was really into like kind of weird sort of performance art type stuff too. So I would be attracted to these like weird performers like Karen Finley or Jesse Bernstein, and I would get their books and read stuff like that. And then, like I said before the show, I didn't go to college or do an MFA or anything like that at all. So I was kind of self-taught with like just reading stuff, and I didn't at that point have any sort of mentor to tell me what to read. So I was just like, reading stuff that I thought would be interesting and stuff that I thought I should read. So I was reading like Kafka and Dostoevsky and like Camus and stuff like that, and all the like banned books, So like I would just read all these banned books and stuff like that.
Lolita, Ulysses, Naked Lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Future Tense has an ebook only imprint I read called Instant Future. I wonder, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about that and why you started that as a separate imprint?
Yeah, it's kind of an experiment, really. I decided to kind of just test out what the ebook thing would be like to publish, small kind of books as ebooks only, and just see like how that would do. Started it 3 or 4 years ago with a couple of other people. Matthew Simmons up in Seattle was kind of the editor for that series. And we actually aren't doing, I don't think we're going to do any more new books in that series. We did 5, but we're producing those ebooks now as chapbooks. So the first 2 ebooks that we put out a couple of years ago have recently come out as chapbooks.
Oh, wow. Back to the roots.
So they are getting like a print life, which I think is important. Yeah, it was just sort of an experiment. I'm not like a huge fan of ebooks myself personally. It was just sort of like, I'm going to see what this is like.
And what are the results of that experiment? So far, so good?
Or? It was okay. It's like kind of a weird, ebooks are a weird landscape because a lot of people who read ebooks, I think, are people who, I mean, I think the general habits of ebook readers are people who really like genre fiction and sort of these kind of disposable, sort of not I don't want to like rile up the genre fiction authors out there, but you know, they're the things that like you wouldn't necessarily want to go and buy the book and have it on your bookshelf. It's like, you know, some of the best-selling ebooks out there are just like the weirdest stuff, you know, like Bigfoot erotica and things like that. I wasn't doing ebooks like that, but that's, yeah, so.
Yeah, I once talked to an editor at Harlequin, and she said a lot of their customers bought ebooks because they didn't want to be caught on the New York subway with a picture of a Fabio-like character. You know, it was embarrassing to them, but they still read the book. And she said their customers would buy 10 to 15 to 20 books a year. I mean, I think mystery novels are the same way. Mm-hmm. Detective novels, whhodunits, maybe true crime too, as you said, genre.
And sometimes they're... they're cheaper, and people can just be like, oh, I'm going to spend, you know, $2.99 on this ebook, and maybe I'll read it, or maybe I won't. So the reading habits, I think, for a lot of people in the ebook market are a little different, too. I think it's important to have ebooks, and I do ebooks for all of the books that we publish now, and I feel like that's a nice kind of supplement. It just makes the book more accessible to people, so especially if they live, like, maybe in another country, but they want to read, like, you know, the Monica Drake book we published, or like Tatiana Reichman's book that we just
published.
They could
buy it over the internet. Yeah, they don't have to worry about bookstore carrying, especially in a country where English is not the spoken language.
Yeah.
Now, I have some questions for all of you. So this is kind of a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. But when doing the research for the show, I found a number of interconnections between you all and your publishing houses. You mentioned one, an author who published with Hawthorne and also Future Tense. But just Tin House published the book, your novel, This Is Between Us. They also published a book, Grow Your Own, Understanding, Cultivating, Enjoying Marijuana. That was co-authored by Liz Crane of Hawthorne Press. She does publicity there, and she's an editor.
And she's written a book for us, too, Food Lover's Guide to Portland.
And that's her kind of forte is food. it's great to talk to her about that. And then Kevin, Future Tense published the latest book. You mentioned Monica Drake, and that's the story collection, The Folly of Loving Life. She's also been published by Hawthorne, in addition to a big New York publisher, too, I think, her second book, The Stud Book.
Crown,
And then, Kevin, you edited the collection Portland Noir that featured Monica Drake, among several others, including Gigi Little, who couldn't be here today, and Lorik. They're at Forest Avenue Press. I can go on about these connections.
So many good people in that book.
Yeah, but I think there'd be, from my point of view, there might be some competition among you as a rival, and I'm doing the kind of air quotes here for people on the radio who don't have the special video viewer. But it seems like an incredible spirit of cooperation, camaraderie, and generosity among you all. I mean, I just noticed that when you walked into the studio.
May I add one thing to that list that you
Oh, certainly,
made,
yes.
Ken? When Hawthorne was launched, and as you mentioned, our first book was Things I Like About America, the first person I went to meet with was Kevin.
Wow.
At Powell's.
To get advice?
To get advice and just talk to him about Poe's collection. And we didn't have a distributor. We were just starting. And so literally, Kevin was my first meeting. And he was so helpful and so supportive. And that's where I started, was with Kevin at Powell's. And we had coffee in the little coffee area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think like the community among us here and other people, other publishers in town, you know, Laura at Forest Avenue, and, you know, anybody else in town that's involved in publishing is, we're all very supportive of each other. I don't, you know, I can't think of any good juicy like rivalries,
right.
You know.
No, like, me either. We're definitely. You know,
I don't know. Maybe we should start one. Maybe Future Tense and Tin House should have like a weird rivalry.
No, we used to have the best parties with with Holly and Lee and Wynn. It was either at my house or the Tin House.
Oh, a Hawthorne Tin House party?
Yeah. Well, I used to have Hawthorne happy hours, remember, Kevin?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and it was just an excuse to get everybody in the community together and have drinks and happy hour, and then Holly would always have the Tin House. Yeah. And so there was this really wonderful, always has been,
definitely
camaraderie of
great
it.
Sense
yeah.
of community. Yeah.
That's why I would never leave Portland. Every once in a while I think about, well, maybe I want to move to, and it's like, no, I can't because I'm part of this community and it's so important.
And it seems that the writers based in Portland that you guys all helped start their careers, when they do go on to a bigger publisher, they still retain a relationship with you.
Oh, definitely.
I'm thinking Monica might be one. Lydia Yuknovich, you published her memoir.
Yeah.
And
well, speaking of Lydia, she's going to be at our Summer Writers Workshop. So there's another connection.
Yeah.
Holly, did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Summer Writers Workshop?
Oh, yeah, where listeners can find out about that.
I mean, that's sure. Just go to our website, tinhouse.com. Yeah, we've got a lot of great people. Robert Boswell. I mean, I can't even name. It's going to be an amazing lineup, and it's coming up July 8th. So everyone should come out and sit there at the amphitheater at Reed College. And we have readings every night featuring three amazing authors per night. It's really fun. I want lectures during the day that are really interesting. So, yeah, it's fun.
Now, as part of our round robin here, I wanted to know the qualities. What are the qualities, the skills, the talents that makes a successful independent publisher?
Passion, I think.
Energy.
Energy. Money.
Patience, I think, is one thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think really hiring the right people. I would say 90% of the people that work at Tin House are